Welcome to this class on engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds. So to make sure that our motivation for being part of this session is an altruistic one, let's take a few minutes to contemplate a few things. So we ourselves want happiness, we want good experiences, we want to feel safe, protected, loved, cared for, appreciated, and to have our needs fulfilled and our wishes fulfilled. There's nothing wrong with feeling that way. We actually deserve to be happy. We shouldn't have to suffer or face bad experiences. And the same is true for everyone else, every human being and every living being also just wants to be happy and have good experiences. And nobody wants pain or problems or bad experiences. So this is universal. It's something we have in common with all living beings. But unfortunately, we don't always have the happiness we wish for, and we continuously face problems that we don't wish for. And this is because, according to Buddhism, there is within our mind afflictive thoughts and emotions, mistaken ways of thinking, like ignorance, not seeing reality, and other afflictive emotions like attachment, greed, anger, hatred, jealousy, pride. So we're born with these. We didn't learn them from anybody. They came with our mind from past lives. They've been there from beginningless time. It's not our fault. It's not the way we chose to be, but it's just the way things are in samsara. We happen to be in samsara. So because of these afflictive thoughts and emotions in our mind, we're confused. We do things to try to find happiness, but they often backfire. We may do the wrong things and create suffering instead of happiness. And we tend to avoid doing the things that actually will bring happiness. This is just because of confusion. Our mind is confused, not clear and correct much of the time. But fortunately, this situation is not something that will last forever. There is a way to change our mind, transform our mind, free our mind from these afflictive thoughts and emotions, and cultivate thoughts and emotions that are positive, constructive, beneficial, that really do bring happiness and peace. The Buddha, who was once like us, an ordinary being, confused, suffering, found a way to transform the mind. He did it in his mind, brought his mind to the state of enlightenment or awakening. And then he spent the rest of his life teaching how to do this. The recipe for a genuine happiness and peace of mind and freedom from suffering. We're really fortunate that we have a chance to learn these teachings and want to practice them and are practicing them to the best of our ability. So let's do this not just for our own benefit, our own happiness, but for the benefit of others, the benefit of all living beings. If we can bring about a transformation of our own mind, we'll be in a better position to help others do the same. So as we're listening to these teachings, thinking about them, reflecting on them, let's wish that whatever transformation we bring about in our own mind will enable us to be more helpful to others, bring about benefit and peace, freedom from suffering for all living beings. So, for those who are joining online and might wonder why I'm sitting here rather than Venerable Children, it's because she's recovering from hip replacement surgery that she had the other day. So I was asked to fill in for her until she's able to resume her teaching duties. And I was asked to do a review of what she's covered so far. So I thought to go back to chapter one and read chapter one again. It's a really beautiful, inspiring, and uplifting chapter. So I think it's really helpful for us, especially right now with all the crazy things going on in this country and in the world, to be able to focus our mind on something really positive and beneficial. And I hope nobody thinks, but we read this already. Do we need to read it again? that happens. Sometimes that thought pops up in our mind. But as we probably know, the teachings of the Buddha are such that we need to read them again and again and contemplate them again and again and meditate on them again and again to really bring about the kind of transformation of our mind I was talking about earlier. One time I was attending some teachings by the Dalai Lama. He was teaching the Lamrim Chenmo, the great exposition of the stages of the path by Lama Tsongkhapa, which is a really huge text. In English, it's three volumes, you know, big, thick volumes like that. So he was reading it and commenting on it. And at that point in time, he said, "I have read this 75 times. And that was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. So it's probably up to 100 by now. I mean, how many books do we read more than once? But, you know, it's the nature of Buddhist books, Buddhist teachings. They are meant to be read again and again. And, you know, not just quickly rushed through and then put aside for another book. But, yeah, each time we read them and think about them and meditate on them, it benefits our mind, makes the teachings go deeper in our mind. Okay, so then I'm going to use the translation of the text from FPMT. It was translated by Toh Suki. It's very similar to Stephen Batchelor's, so if you're using that, you won't have any trouble following it. I mean, all the different translations are quite similar. So I don't know if you have these files. I think they were made available to you in the past. There's one file that has just the root verses translated by Suki, and another file that has the root verses plus a commentary by the abbot Drakpa Gyaltsen. I like that commentary. It's kind of nice and clear. So that's the one I'm going to use. So the text, again, is all about the cultivation of bodhicitta, the mind aspiring to become a Buddha, fully enlightened, to be able to benefit all sentient beings. So how to cultivate that state of mind, and then how to practice the deeds of bodhisattvas, the activities a bodhisattva needs to engage in order to actually become enlightened. So it's easy to feel inspired by the idea of becoming enlightened. I know that was probably the main thing that grabbed me when I first started learning Buddhism from the Tibetan lamas way back then. I was just so inspired by the idea of bodhicitta, becoming a Buddha to help all living beings. So it's easy to feel inspired by that. But we have to understand that that is only possible if we create the causes, the right causes. So it's similar if we want to have a nice garden with lots of vegetables and flowers and fruits growing. we have to do some work. We have to, you know, make the soil ready and plant the seeds and water them and take care of the little plants as they're coming up. So a lot of work to make a garden, as people here know. So enlightenment, Buddhahood, is similar. It's like an abundant harvest of excellent qualities and abilities to benefit all living beings. Not just in a temporary way, but in an ultimate way, helping all living beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, and help them have genuine happiness and up to full enlightenment, becoming Buddhas themselves. So if we want that kind of harvest, we have to put time and energy into creating the causes for it, planting the seeds and taking care of those little seeds as they're growing. And so it does take time, it does take energy. And so where do we get that energy? It's by understanding the benefits of cultivating bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. So that's the subject matter of chapter one, the first chapter. So this first chapter of the text is, it's all about the benefits, and it has 36 verses. Some of the verses are really beautiful, inspiring. So again, we need to understand bodhicitta isn't something that's just going to pop up in our minds all by itself, spontaneously, unless maybe in a past life you did do all the work, put in a lot of time and energy to create the causes for bodhicitta. So then in this lifetime, it might just pop up easily and naturally. But if that doesn't happen, if it's a struggle, you know, if you're still struggling with self-centeredness and, you know, all the other afflictions, then that shows, you know, we need to put more time and energy into creating the causes. And there are causes for cultivating bodhicitta. There's two main methods for cultivating bodhicitta, such as the sevenfold or seven-point cause and effect method, and another method that has 5 points. It's called equalizing and exchanging self with others. And that's the main method in this text. And it doesn't come until later, I think chapter 8. But anyway, we've all heard it before and done meditation on it before. So we do know the methods for cultivating bodhicitta. So we just need to understand, make clear to our minds that we have to keep learning about, thinking about, and meditating on, working on, developing these thoughts, these attitudes in our mind. Okay, so the text starts by saying, homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That's actually the homage by the translator, the person who translated this text from Sanskrit into Tibetan. And Shantideva's own words start with verse 1, where he also pays homage to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but in a slightly different way. So he says, respectfully, I pay homage to the Sugatas. Sugata is another term for Buddha, who are endowed with the Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya, or sometimes translated as truth body, this mainly refers to the mind of the Buddha, the mind of a fully enlightened being. So this is a mind that is totally free of every kind of obstacle, obscuration. Mainly there's two kinds of obscurations, and they're translated differently. The first kind is sometimes called afflictive obscurations. So those are all the afflictive emotions or afflictive states of mind: greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy, and so on. So they are states of mind that disturb the mind and often lead us to do unwholesome, unskillful actions. And they also prevent the attainment of nirvana or liberation from samsara. So those are the things that need to be gotten rid of, eliminated, for our mind to be free of samsara, the cycle of death and rebirth. But they also have to be eliminated to attain full enlightenment. So those have to be cleared away. And then the second kind of obscuration, sometimes called cognitive obscurations or obscurations to omniscience or knowledge obscurations. So those are, there's different assertions about it, but according to Madhyamika Prasangika school, that's the school Shantideva belongs to, they're not consciousness, they're not minds, but they are, what's the term? Abstract composites. I'm used to saying non-associated compositional factors, which is a, you know, pretty precise translation of the Tibetan term, but it's a real mouthful. So abstract composites a lot easier to say. So these are, it's another kind of phenomena, not mind, not matter, but impermanent things that are neither of those two. They're like imprints or seeds left in our mind by afflictive emotions, especially ignorance. So they're sometimes compared to the smell of some kind of smelly food, like garlic or onions or durians. Those who know durians. So foods that has a really strong smell. And even if you take it away, you know, the smell lingers in the air for a while. So so in a similar way, even after our mind has been freed from the afflictive obscurations, greed, hatred, ignorance, and so on, those are gone. Those are out of the mind. But there's still the smell remaining for a while. And that takes more work to purify, to clear away. So these obscurations to omniscience or cognitive obscurations, they cause our mind to see things as inherently existing or truly existing, which is a false mode of existence. Things don't exist that way. But we continue seeing things that way because of such long habituation to that state of mind. The things still appear as if they're inherently existing, even though you know they're not. It's like an illusion, a false mode of existence. So even a bodhisattva who's totally cleared away all the afflictive emotions, they still have the smell of those afflictive emotions. They still have this tendency to see things as truly existing or inherently existing. So that those have to be cleared away as well, purified. So when those have been totally purified, the mind becomes fully enlightened. Buddha mind, omniscient mind. So that's one way of understanding omniscient mind. Buddha mind is it's free of all the obscurations, both the afflictive obscurations, the cognitive obscurations, totally free of everything that's a problem, and fully developed in everything that's positive. All the good qualities like compassion and love and wisdom and so on and so on. The positive states of mind, they've been fully developed, fully perfected to the highest degree. So it's an amazing state of mind. And in that state of mind, of course, one has so many abilities to help others, being able to manifest in different forms and go here and there and all over the place, all the different realms of the universe, even at the same time with zillions of emanations and help sentient beings. So anyway, the Buddhas are endowed with that mind, the Dharmakaya. So Shantideva is paying homage to them. And then their children, which refer to the Bodhisattvas, that's another term for Bodhisattva, children of the Buddhas, because they will inherit, they will attain Buddhahood, just like the child of a king will inherit the throne when the king passes away. So in the same way, the bodhisattvas will attain the state of enlightenment. And to all who are worthy of homage. So he's paying homage basically to all objects of refuge. And then he says what he's going to do in this text. Here I shall describe how to engage in the vows of the Sugata's children, the Bodhisattvas, the meaning of which I have summarized in accordance with the scriptures. The next verse, verse 2, he says, there is nothing here that has not appeared in the past, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. Therefore, not to enact the welfare of others, I compose this in order to acquaint it to my mind. So that third line in the verse is a little surprising, because it almost sounds like he's saying, I'm not doing this to help others. I used to wonder about that, but in the commentary by Drakpa Gyaltsen, the way it's explained is he's being humble. This is an expression of humility, because he's saying, I'm composing this text, but what I'm saying is nothing new. It's already been explained before in other scriptures, and there's nothing wrong with those scriptures. There's nothing deficient, inadequate, faulty with those scriptures. So it's not like I'm saying, oh, well, they didn't explain it very well, so I have to do it. I have to do a new version that's going to be better. So he's not saying that at all. On the contrary, he's saying, you know, those former scriptures are perfect just as they are, and people will be able to understand the full meaning by relying on those scriptures. So, yeah, he's just being very humble, and he's also saying, I don't have skill in rhetoric. I'm not really, which obviously is not really true, because it's such an amazing text. But he's being humble rather than arrogant and, you know, presumptuous. And so he's saying, I'm composing this for my own benefit, to acquaint my own mind with these teachings. And but he does say, you know, there might be some benefit to others. So he says that in the next verse. He says, for due to acquaintance with virtue, the force of my faith will for the time being increase because of these. If, however, these are seen by others, equal in fortune to myself, it will be meaningful. So he's saying, I'm composing this text to make my mind more acquainted with and more familiar with these teachings. And this is a really important idea. Like I was saying before, you know, that's why we have to read and think about and meditate on the same ideas again and again and again, to familiarize our mind with them, with these teachings. And that's how we bring about a transformation of our mind. So it's similar with someone who's like a accomplished artist or musician or athlete. They weren't like that from the beginning, but they practiced many hours a day, day after day, month after month, year after year. And by that continuous effort in practicing, they became really accomplished. So it's similar with practitioners, Dharma practitioners of whatever path, and here we're talking about the Bodhisattva path. So nobody starts out right from the beginning as an accomplished Bodhisattva, but over time, by familiarizing themselves again and again and again with the methods for cultivating bodhicitta and benefiting others and so on, they became masters. They became accomplished in these. So familiarizing ourselves with these teachings, with these ideas, increases the positive qualities in our mind, such as faith and wisdom, compassion, love, and of course, bodhicitta, and also our virtue. It's a way of accumulating virtue. Then verse 4 says, this is talking about the perfect human rebirth, precious human rebirth. The leisures and endowments are very hard to find, since they accomplish the purposes of beings. If I do not accomplish benefit upon this, how will I acquire this in the future? So this is a topic we've heard many times and meditated on many times, but again, it doesn't hurt to hear about it again. So we're really fortunate to be human beings, and not just human beings, but to have all the ideal conditions, you know, healthy body and functioning mind and the opportunity to learn the teachings. That's really the most precious thing about our life. And then support from friends, from benefactors, from fellow members of the community. It's not easy to practice Dharma. And so we do need a lot of help and support, both in terms of resources, like people offering us food and toilet paper and all these things, and money to build the buildings where we live and practice and so on. So, you know, here in the Abbey, we're incredibly fortunate to get that kind of support. And then also spiritual support, emotional support. You know, just practicing all by yourself is really hard. Some people are able to do it. They go off into a cave or a hut somewhere and they can just stay all by themselves and keep going. But that's real hard to do. Not everyone is able to do that. So it's really helpful to have a community of practitioners dedicated to the same goals and supporting us when we get down and or sick or whatever. So here, especially here in the Abbey, we're incredibly fortunate to have all these. And then, of course, teachers. We need to keep learning the Dharma, even if it's the same teachings again and again and again, but also new teachings. It's always good to learn new things. So we have teachers, resident teachers, and teachers from afar who are now able to teach us by Zoom, even if they're on the other side of the world. And then, of course, all these, you know, these amazing technology that enables that to happen. So we're really, really, really fortunate. And not easy to have this kind of situation with all these conditions. So we really must, you know, enthuse ourselves, inspire ourselves to use it wisely and skillfully. And the best way to use this life is practicing Dharma, especially the Bodhisattva's path, working for enlightenment to benefit all living beings. And remember, no guarantee that this set of circumstances will continue in the future. Things could change, even in our lifetime. But then definitely this life will end, and who knows where we're going to go. So we really have to use our time wisely while we can. Then the next set of verses starts to talk about the benefits of bodhicitta. So verse 5 says, just as a flash of lightning brightly illuminates for an instant within the clouds on a dark night, likewise in this world, through the might of the Buddha, merit and intelligence occasionally occur for once. And the next verse says, hence virtue is perpetually feeble. The great power of negativity is horrible. Except for a mind of complete enlightenment, by what other virtue will it be overcome? So he's saying here that in the world, there's a lot more negativity than there is virtue and merit and, you know, positive thoughts. Sounds kind of you know, depressive. I like to think, well, there is a lot of good in the world. Like, you know, as usual, the news is all about the crazy things, the negative things, the harmful things that are going on. But we have to remind ourselves, I have to remind myself that, you know, there's so many acts of kindness happening every single day, probably every minute. There's just being kind to each other, parents being kind to their children, feeding them, you know, clothing them, teachers, you know, teaching their students, and healthcare workers taking care of those who are sick and elderly, and social workers taking care of those who are down and out, and so on. So just those things that are happening every single day, everywhere in the world, there are people doing kind things to others. It just doesn't make the headlines, but they are happening. And all of those kind deeds happen because of, you know, we have within our minds, everyone has within our minds, basic kindness and compassion and the wish to benefit others. So these are natural qualities. And, but yeah, there's also a lot of negativity. We can't deny that. So he's just saying that, yeah, that when people do acts of kindness and intelligence, wisdom, and so forth. It's through the power of the Buddha. And I think that's because, you know, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are working in the world. We may not always see them. We may not always know who they are, where they are, what they're doing, but they are there, inspiring people, teaching people, helping people to cultivate these positive qualities and act on them. But in general, virtue is weaker than negativity. I think we can see that if just looking at our own minds, you know, it's a lot easier. You probably heard this saying in the Tibetan tradition. They say that having negative thoughts and following negative thoughts is like a boulder rolling down a hill. But having positive thoughts and doing virtuous things is like trying to push a boulder up a hill. Have you heard that one? Anyway, it was comforting for me to hear that. Yeah, but I mean, that's just the nature of our minds. It's just so easy to fall into negativity, you know, whether it's downright anger or just depression and despair and unhappiness. That just happens so easily. But to get ourselves into a positive state of mind, we have to make effort. It doesn't come naturally and easily. Maybe for some people occasionally, but I know for me, I really have to work at it. So it's just kind of comforting to know, well, that's just the nature of things. That's the nature of our existence in samsara. Non-virtue comes easily, spontaneously, but virtue and, you know, positive states of mind require effort. But this mind of bodhicitta is a very powerful force for virtue, for merit. So if we have the chance to cultivate this state of mind and do things with that motivation of bodhicitta, then we're able to create a vast amount of merit. So it goes on to say, verse 7, all the lords of subduers, that's another term for Buddhas, who have contemplated for many eons, have seen it to be beneficial. For by it, the immeasurable masses of beings will easily attain the supreme happiness. So it's saying all the Buddhas agree, and they've thought about this for a long time, many eons. They all agree that this state of mind of bodhicitta, aspiring to become enlightened, to help all living beings, is incredibly beneficial, because it will eliminate the suffering of sentient beings and bring them peace and happiness. The next verse says, those who wish to destroy the multitudes of sufferings of existence, those who wish to dispel the unhappiness of sentient beings, and those who wish to enjoy multitudes of happiness should never forsake the mind of enlightenment. So these are some of the benefits of generating bodhicitta, that by it, we can eliminate the sufferings of samsara, both for ourselves and for others. And by it, we can eliminate the unhappiness of sentient beings and experience great happiness. So it brings great benefit to ourselves and to others. So as I was saying yesterday in the BBC, you know, it doesn't help at all to feel despair about all the negativity in the world and all the harmful things, the unethical things that are being done by people. These things are impermanent. They are not going to be there forever. And they come about because of afflictive mental states, such as ignorance, greed, hatred, and so on, these mental toxins, mental diseases, we could call them. And they too are impermanent. They're not going to be there forever. They're not in the nature of the mind. They are not incurable diseases. They are curable. So Buddha discovered the cure for these diseases, and he taught it. And we have the chance to learn about it. We have access to the methods, the cures for these mental toxins. And we have all the other conditions in our lives that we can start putting them into practice. So again, we need to get ourselves out of feelings of depression, despair, unhappiness about what's going on in the world. Of course, we need to be aware of all of these things and have compassion and do what we can to help them, but put our energy into practices that will enable us to bring about a transformation of our own minds, and then we're in a better position to be able to help others, and especially bodhicitta. Whatever effort we can make to cultivate bodhicitta and do things with the bodhicitta motivation. So this will get us started on the path to enlightenment. And Shantideva says, this is the way to eliminate all suffering and to experience great happiness. When the mind of enlightenment is generated, in that moment, those wretched ones fettered in the jail of cyclic existence will be called child of the Sugatas and will become objects of reverence by humans and gods of the world. So when someone generates bodhicitta, I mean, I think this is talking about uncontrived bodhicitta, natural, spontaneous. You don't have to make effort to generate it. But before that, you do have to make effort. You have to make effort to generate bodhicitta in a contrived way, but then eventually it becomes natural, spontaneous, uncontrived. So when it gets to that point, then the person gets this name, child of the Sugatas or Bodhisattva. And this person is worthy of reverence by everybody, human beings and gods. So, for example, we can look at His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. So many people, and not just Buddhists, but people of other religions and even politicians and even, you know, scientists and all kinds of people recognize His wonderful qualities and feel great respect for Him. And it was funny, I just remembered one time long ago, I was teaching in North Carolina, and Jesse Helms, you know Jesse Helms? He was a senator, I think. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he was a senator for a long time. And I guess he was something of a racist. And but apparently he really liked the Dalai Lama. So there was one time a friend of mine from over there was at a teaching, and I guess Jesse Helms was there introducing the Dalai Lama, and it looked like they were great friends, and she was just like, she had a very different view of Jesse Helms. But that helped her mind be more open to him. But yeah, it just shows, you know, so many people of all different states of mind and political persuasions and ways of behaving and so on can see the good qualities and appreciate someone who's a bodhisattva. Yeah, and then verse 10 says, like the supreme gold-making elixir, it takes the unclean body and transforms it into the priceless jewel, a Buddha's body, a victor's body. Therefore, firmly seize this so-called mind of enlightenment. So this is referring to this ancient art or science, I don't know, pseudoscience of alchemy. I don't know if there are people who are still doing this or it was in the past, you know, people were involved in trying to find some material that would transform ordinary things, ordinary metals into gold. And so that's the alchemist's stuff, gold-making elixir. So whether such a thing exists or not, I don't know. But anyway, saying that bodhicitta is like that. It has this transformative power that an ordinary being, and you know, sentient being, deluded, miserable sentient being, as soon as that person develops bodhicitta, they are transformed into something incredibly precious, priceless, a Buddha. Well, I mean, not immediately. As soon as you develop bodhicitta, you don't become a Buddha. But through the power of bodhicitta, once you generate bodhicitta, you're definitely on the way. You're on track to become a Buddha. So it's very, very precious, very powerful. Verse 11, since the soul helmsman helmsman of migrating beings, the limitless mind, has upon thorough investigation seen its preciousness, all beings wishing to be free from the boats of migration, firmly sees this precious mind of enlightenment. So I guess helmsmen refer to Buddhas. So the Buddhas were the helmsmen, the captains taking sentient beings out of samsara, taking them to enlightenment. Again, see how precious bodhicitta is, then we should really firmly seize it, work on developing it. And then verse 12 says, all other virtues are like the plantain tree, for after bearing fruit, they will be exhausted. But the tree of the mind of enlightenment will constantly bear fruit, whereby it is inexhaustible and flourishes more and more. So plantain tree, I guess, just produces fruit once and then it's finished. So it's kind of not very beneficial. But there's another kind of tree called a perennial tree, I think. Perennial tree, is that right? I looked it up. Yeah, that's a tree that keeps bearing fruit every year for a long, long, long time, maybe forever. So he's saying other kinds of virtue are like the plantain tree. One time of bearing fruit and then they're finished. But the tree of bodhicitta will continue to bring benefit again and again and again. So it's said that when we do something with bodhicitta motivation, then we're creating the cause to become enlightened. So it becomes the cause to bring enlightenment. That's the long-term goal. But it will also bring all the good results between now and enlightenment. That means good rebirths in our future lives, where we have all the conditions that we need to keep practicing the Dharma. We'll be happy, things will go well for us. And then all the realizations of the path will also occur. And these make our mind more and more happy and pure and positive. So doing things with bodhicitta doesn't just bring the long-term goal of enlightenment, but all the good things on the way to enlightenment. And then once we do reach enlightenment, it doesn't end there, because then you're a Buddha and you can just be constantly, spontaneously working for the benefit of all sentient beings until everyone is free of samsara. So all of those benefits, all of those results, beneficial results, both for yourself, for other sentient beings, come from bodhicitta. So that's why it's said to be like this perennial tree that just continues, like our apple trees here, you know, they just continue producing all these apples more than we can handle almost. Whereas other virtues, like creating virtue without bodhicitta, maybe for a more limited reason, goal, then once that result comes, then it's finished. But bodhicitta keeps bringing more and more results again and again. And in the commentary, there was a quote from the teachings of Akshayamati Sutra. So it's probably a Mahayana Sutra. And this sutra says that just as a drop of water that falls into the great ocean will not be exhausted until the end of the eon, also virtues that are dedicated will not be exhausted until the essence of enlightenment is reached. For me, that image is really, really helpful. If you think about, you know, the vast ocean, if you have a drop of water, if it's just left there on the table, it'll quickly dry up and disappear. But if you put it in the ocean, it merges with the water of the ocean and it's never going to disappear. Well, unless, you know, the earth burns up and the ocean dries up. But anyway, for a long time, it'll remain there. So in a similar way, when we create virtue and we dedicate that virtue to enlightenment with bodhicitta, and I think of it as adding our virtue to this great ocean of virtue, merit that's created by all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with their bodhicitta. So my little virtue gets added to their vast ocean of virtue and won't be dried up, won't be exhausted. I'm not sure if that's the correct way of thinking, but that's how I think about it. And I find that really powerful, really helpful, adding my merits to this huge ocean of merits dedicated to the enlightenment of all living beings. So that's what we do when we create virtue, do things with bodhicitta motivation, and then dedicate our merits to that goal. And then the next two verses are about how not only does bodhicitta enable us to create a lot of merit, a lot of virtue, but also purify a vast amount of negativity, demerit. So it says, verse 13, like depending on a hero when greatly afraid, even if I may have committed very terrible negativities, I shall be swiftly liberated in dependence upon it. Why then do those who have the imprints not depend on it? So even if we've created really awful things in our life, murder even, nothing is so bad, so negative, that it can't be purified. And bodhicitta, if we generate bodhicitta and try to act, do our actions on the basis of the bodhicitta motivation, that is said to be a very powerful antidote to negativities, to non-virtue. So we need to have confidence that, yeah, we're not hopeless. It's not hopeless. Whatever we have done can definitely be purified, especially with bodhicitta. And the next verse says the same. Just like the fire at the end of time, in an instant, it certainly burns up the great negativities. Its unfathomable benefits were explained to Sudana by the wise protector Maitreya. So the Buddha himself and Maitreya spoke about these benefits of bodhicitta. So the next part is talking about the two kinds of bodhicittas. Verse 15, in brief, you should understand the mind of enlightenment to be of two types, the mind that wishes enlightenment and the mind that engages enlightenment. So these two are often called wishing bodhicitta or aspiring bodhicitta. So that's the wish to become fully enlightened. And then the second one is engaging bodhicitta. I don't know, is there another term? And then the next verse explains the difference between them, as is understood by the instances of desiring to go and going. So the wise should understand respectively the distinction between these two. So aspiring bodhicitta is compared to having the wish to go somewhere. We probably have this kind of thought a lot. We've been stuck here a long time, right? Since March or many of you, since last winter, haven't been able to go anywhere and visit family or go and teach somewhere. So we probably have lots of thoughts coming up. I want to go to such and such place. So that's like wishing bodhicitta. Wishing bodhicitta or aspiring bodhicitta is the wish to go to enlightenment, to be enlightened, to attain that state. But sometimes we have the wish to go somewhere, but it doesn't go any further than that, especially now we're locked down. We can't go anywhere. But if we did have, you know, if the lockdown is lifted, we have the chance to travel, then we can start making plans, buying air tickets and getting visas and packing our bags and so on and so forth. So that's like engaging bodhicitta. That's when you go beyond just wishing to go somewhere and you're actually making the move, doing the things you have to do to get there. So engaging bodhicitta isn't just wishing to reach enlightenment, but you're starting to do the practices. Actually, realistically, we start doing the practices for reaching enlightenment even before we generate aspiring bodhicitta. Like right now, we're trying to practice the six perfections to some degree, you know, giving and ethics and so forth. But it doesn't really become engaging bodhicitta until we have actual bodhicitta, the uncontrived bodhicitta in our mind. So when a person has generated uncontrived bodhicitta and then they start practicing giving and ethics and so on and so forth, then that's officially the meaning of engaging bodhicitta. On the basis of uncontrived bodhicitta, they are actively creating the causes for enlightenment. So it includes the six perfections, bodhisattva vows, anything we do, anything one does with the mind of enlightenment, the bodhicitta motivation. And the difference between, in terms of benefit or merit, is the next verse, verse 17, although great fruits arise, will arise in cyclic existence from the mind that wishes for enlightenment, an uninterrupted flow of merit will not arise, as in the case of the engaging mind. So it's very beneficial. We create a lot of merit, a lot of virtue, by just wishing to go to enlightenment, to reach enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. But the merit of engaging bodhicitta, actually doing it, actually creating the causes to reach enlightenment, brings much more merit. And then he elaborates on that in the next verses. Verse 18, for one who has perfectly adopted this mind with the thought never to turn away for the sake of totally liberating the infinite realms of sentient beings, from that time onwards, even while asleep or lacking conscientiousness, a force of merit equal to the sky will continuously ensue. So for someone who has generated this uncontrived bodhicitta and has become an actual bodhisattva, even when they're asleep, or if their mind is distracted, even during those times, it said that a force of merit equal to the sky will continuously ensue. So they're creating merit even when they're asleep. And I seem to recall, I was looking for the source this morning, but when I was studying in the master's program, one of my teachers said, from the time you generate uncontrived bodhicitta, your mind is never separate from bodhicitta. It's there all of the time. Either wishing, like, you know, at certain points, it's just the wishing bodhicitta, or when you're actually engaged in activities, bodhisattva deeds, then it becomes engaging bodhicitta. But there's never a moment when you don't have one of those two types of bodhicitta. In the case of being asleep, then maybe it just becomes dormant or non-manifest, but it's still there. It never just ceases. So that's pretty amazing. So let's get there. Let's get to that point. And then he says, for the sake of those inclined towards the lower, this is taught along with the correctness by the Tathagata himself in the sutra requested by Subahu. So I didn't look at that. What is the meaning of the lower? I presume that means the Hinayana, in case somebody's kind of attracted to that vehicle. Yeah, the lower vehicle. So, yeah, so in this sutra, the sutra requested by Bodhisattva Subahu, the Tathagata, the Buddha, taught the benefits of the engaging mind for the sake of sentient beings inclined towards the lower vehicle, the Hinayana, the path to nirvana, self-liberation. It says here, some indefinite in the hearer's lineage who fear the accumulation of extensive collections and who, having turned away from the great vehicle, seek the hearer's enlightenment. So, yeah, I guess when, you know, some people hear about all the work you have to do to reach enlightenment, you can get scared. Oh, I don't think I can do that. And you might think, oh, yeah. The enlightenment of a hearer or enlightenment of a solitary realizer will seem more manageable, more doable. So maybe I'll go for that. So the Buddha taught this in order to change their minds and get them back into the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Okay, then verse 21 says, if even the thought to relieve sentient beings of merely a headache possesses the attitude to benefit and possesses boundless merit, then what need is there to mention the desire to dispel the boundless unhappiness of each sentient being and to accomplish boundless good qualities of every single one of them? So if someone had this idea, this aspiration to find a cure for headaches, I'm sure many people here would be appreciative of that. Headaches can be really unpleasant, really horrible. So if somebody could find a cure for headaches, especially migraine headaches, that would be amazing. That would be greatly worthy of praise and rejoicing and so on. And merit, of course, that this would be very meritorious. But that's wishing to eliminate just one type of suffering that sentient beings have. And even if someone did find a cure for headaches, for migraines, there's still so many other kinds of suffering, so many other kinds of physical diseases and troubles, physical troubles with our body, and also mental and emotional ones, and so on and so forth. So there's so many other sufferings and causes of suffering that sentient beings have to face. So a bodhisattva is somebody who doesn't just want to eliminate one kind of suffering, but every single suffering and cause of suffering for every single sentient being. Kind of amazing, inconceivable. So someone who has such an attitude, such a, not just wish, but is actually engaged in doing that, doing what it takes to eliminate every single suffering. So this is really amazing, really worthy of respect and praise and support. And then verse 23 says, who has such an altruistic intention as this? Do even fathers and mothers have it? Do the gods and sages? Does even Brahma have it? So mothers and fathers, of course, love their children and want their children to be free of suffering. But their idea about what constitutes suffering and what needs to be done to eliminate the suffering of their children will be limited by their, they just don't know all the different kinds of suffering that their children might encounter. And also, what are the causes of those sufferings? So parents are often helpless when they see their children physically ill or in pain or mentally, emotionally unhappy. You know, they really, really want to relieve their children of their suffering, but their knowledge and their ability to do that is very much limited. And also, you know, to eliminate every single suffering that their children have, not just the obvious ones, but the karma, the afflictions in the mind, this whole situation of dying and taking rebirth over and over and over again. Most mothers and fathers probably have no idea about that and have that kind of wish, that kind of intention for their children, unless the parents are bodhisattvas. But ordinary fathers and mothers don't have such an intention. And the gods, the sages, again, those who are not bodhisattvas would not have such an intention. Brahma is one of the gods in the Hindu pantheon. He's in the form realm, so he's pretty high up there. But and also, he's said to have, you know, immeasurable love and compassion, and those four immeasurables, the four immeasurable thoughts, they're also known as the four Brahma Viharas. So that means the abodes of Brahma. Brahma has those states of mind. So he does have a great deal of love and kindness and compassion, but how far does that extend? Does it extend to the thought, I am going to relieve every single sentient being in the universe of every single suffering that they have and its causes and lead them all to enlightenment? So probably not. So if those beings have not even dreamt before of such an attitude for their own welfare in their dreams, how can they generate it for the welfare of others? So, you know, even for oneself, you know, everybody wants happiness for oneself. Everyone wants to rid themselves of suffering. But again, most people's ideas of what that means is very limited. You know, we don't know all the different kinds of suffering that there are and the causes of those sufferings and want to free ourselves from them and all the different kinds of happiness that are available up to enlightenment and want to achieve those for ourselves. So even for oneself to have all those happinesses and freedom from suffering, you know, most people don't think that way. So in the next verse, he says, such a mind of welfare of sentient beings does not arise even for their own sake. Yeah. So that's something to think about. He's stating that, but we need to check if that's true or not. We can ask ourselves, do I think that way for myself? Do I think of eliminating every single suffering and cause of suffering for myself? Am I dedicated to doing that? I mean, of course, the hearers and the solitary realizers want to free themselves from suffering and achieve happiness. But their idea of happiness is nirvana, solitary peace. Still not the full enlightenment of Buddhahood, full awakening. So what they achieve for themselves is elimination of all the afflictive obscurations. Obscurations that prevent nirvana, but they don't eliminate the second kind of obscuration, the obscurations of omniscience. Whether they even know about them is another thing. But, you know, they're content with just eliminating that first kind of obscuration and reaching nirvana, but their mind still has these other obscurations that prevent their mind from being fully enlightened, fully perfected and able to benefit all living beings. So they are the ones who probably have the highest degree of wish for happiness for oneself, but still it's limited. Not as full as the mind of bodhicitta, mind of enlightenment. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm just babbling, but He's just saying, you know, look at all the beings around the world and can you find any example of anyone who has such a mind of wishing for happiness and wishing to relieve suffering as the bodhisattvas do? So then he says, an outstanding jewel of the mind, an unprecedented wonder is born. Yeah? So if you do this kind of investigation, you will come to the point where you think, wow, bodhicitta is amazing, an unprecedented wonder. Verse 26 says, how can I fathom the merits of this jewel mind, the cause of joy of all migrating beings, and the panacea for the suffering of sentient beings? You say, you know, when we first hear about bodhicitta, we might think, oh yeah, that sounds good, I want to do that. But, I mean, in my experience, especially when I did the master's program and we studied the ornament for clear realization, the Abhisamayalamkara, which really explains the details of the bodhisattva's path. It's like, ah, yeah, there's a lot that you have to do to reach enlightenment, a lot more than you find in the Lam Rim or in Lojong. It's really awesome, amazing, the things that, you know, that have to be done in order to actually become a Buddha, like fully enlightened. It's pretty amazing. So to take that on, you know, to take on that commitment is really amazing. It's really an awesome thing. And then 127, if merely a benevolent intention excels venerating the Buddhas, than what need to mention, striving to make all beings without exception happy. Yeah, so in the commentary it says, it is taught in the King of Concentration Sutra, the Samadhi Raja Sutra, that merely a benevolent thought, thinking, may I become a Buddha in order to protect all migrating beings, excels in merit the worshipping of as many Buddhas as there are in billions of Buddha fields. Wow. So just to have that thought is incredibly powerful. Then what need is there to mention the infinite merit in making effort in extensive exertion of practices accomplished for the sake of accomplishing the unsurpassed happiness of all sentient beings without exception? So just having the thought, I want to become enlightened, help all sentient beings, is a vast merit, more than venerating billions of Buddhas. Then, even more than that, if you actually start engaging in the activities, doing the practices, the deeds, bring yourself to enlightenment is just inexpressibly great. And again, it's beneficial for others, beneficial for ourselves. The very best thing that we can do. And the next verse is really powerful, very powerful reflection that helps us generate compassion, loving kindness, bodhicitta. It says, although wishing to be rid of misery, they run towards misery itself. Although wishing to have happiness like an enemy, they ignorantly destroy it. So this is talking about ordinary sentient beings. We all want happiness. We all wish not to suffer. And yet, because our minds are confused about what is the cause of happiness, what is the cause of suffering, many people just do the opposite. We can see that very much now in the world, in this country, you know. I was just thinking, it's just kind of amazing that people don't seem to care about the truth. Well, some people do, but many people, even when they're presented with truth, the facts, the real facts, they reject it in favor of disinformation, misinformation, lies, falsehoods. It's kind of like, what happened to this world? It wasn't like that when I was a kid, or maybe I was naive. I didn't really understand what was going on. But yeah, it's probably always been like that for some people. They prefer, you know, lies to truth. They prefer delusion to what's true and beneficial. But yeah, it's become really, really obvious right now. They prefer harmful behavior to beneficial behavior, even for yourself. You know, so many people harming themselves with drugs, with alcohol, with, I don't know, just numbing their minds with video games and stupid things. Yeah, so we want to be free of suffering, but we're doing things that just increase suffering, create more suffering, not only for others, but also for ourselves. We want to be happy, but when it comes to the actual causes of happiness, like virtue, you know, practicing the 10 virtuous actions, living ethically, being kind and beneficial, giving and so on. A lot of people, not for me, no thanks, I don't want to do that. And even destroying it, even destroying the causes of virtue. So this isn't true for everyone, of course, but a lot of people. So, you know, if we think this way, if we can understand this is what's going on for people and for sentient beings, then it brings up compassion in our heart. Instead of being angry and annoyed at them, then you have to have compassion for them. They're just confused. They're just doing the opposite of what will really bring genuine peace and happiness. So I seem to recall listening to teachings, the Lama's teachings, they often quote this verse, and you know, to help us, yeah, generate compassion and the bodhicitta motivation. It's so true. We have to have compassion for sentient beings. Next couple of verses, also more about the benefits of bodhicitta. For those who are deprived of happiness and burdened with many sorrows, it satisfies them with all joys, dispels all suffering, and clears away confusion. Where is there a comparable virtue? Where is there even such a friend? Where is there merit similar to this? So these are benefits we will experience even, you know, we're not yet bodhisattvas. I know I'm not yet a bodhisattva, but just trying to contemplate bodhicitta and trying to make that my motivation for the things that we do, you know, it definitely brings happiness and clears away suffering, clears away confusion. So it's really, really beneficial, really powerful. Again, it's helpful to compare this with other positive states of mind and positive intentions and actions that people are doing, like trying to find a vaccine for COVID or a cure for cancer, relieving hunger. I mean, these are wonderful things. And of course, they should be supported and encouraged to do these things. But again, you know, even if they find a cure for COVID, that would be fantastic. But there's still a lot of other diseases out there, and probably new ones will pop up. And even if they take away everybody's hunger, make sure everyone has enough to eat, but there's still suffering, especially mental suffering, which is much harder. I heard Mother Teresa say something like that, that you know, relieving the suffering of in the East is relatively easy. It's just moving food and clothes and, you know, physical things. But the suffering in the West is much, much harder. It's more mental suffering, much harder to relieve that. So, I mean, of course, we do what we can and we support others who are doing what they can to relieve suffering. But Buddhism's awareness of suffering is so much deeper than most people in the world. Most people are just aware of the first kind of suffering, the suffering of suffering, the obvious physical and mental suffering. Most people aren't aware of the second type of suffering, the suffering of change. Even if you have everything you need, you're still going to be unhappy because that pleasure doesn't last. You're left feeling empty. And then the third type of suffering is the deepest of all. And in fact, like His Holiness said, it's only Buddhists who really recognize that, the pervasive compounded suffering. Just the fact that our mind, our being, is under the control of karma and afflictive emotions. That's the real suffering that as Buddhists we want to free ourselves from and as bodhisattvas free other beings from. So as long as that situation continues, we're still under the control of delusions and karma. We might cycle in samsara and go up to the highest realms where it's beautiful and wonderful and peaceful and blissful, but only for so long. And then you fall down again. So the real thing we need to eliminate is that type of suffering, third type of suffering. And the way to do that is overcome ignorance, the root of samsara, ignorance that grasps the thing as truly existing. And then verse 31, if whoever reciprocates benefit is worthy of some praise, then what need to mention a bodhisattva who does good without its being asked of him or her? So when someone does a kind deed, even if it's just giving us a cup of water when we're thirsty, then it's only right that we feel grateful, appreciative, thankful, and want to do what we can to help that person in return. So when it comes to bodhisattvas who, you know, are working for the benefit of every sentient being, totally dedicated to helping us be free of all our suffering and the causes of suffering, helping us achieve every kind of happiness up to enlightenment, then of course we need to feel grateful, appreciative, and do what we can to support them. support what they're doing. And he continues this in the next couple of verses. The world honors as virtuous a man who procures mediocre food and for an instant gives it disrespectfully to a small number of beings that satisfies them only for half a day. What need be said then of one who constantly bestows the unsurpassed bliss of the Sugatas for a long time upon countless sentient beings, fulfilling all their hopes? Yeah, so when someone, you know, gives maybe a limited amount of food to a limited number of beings, that person is greatly praised, greatly honored. So if that's the case, when it comes to the bodhisattvas who are totally dedicated to giving not just a small amount of happiness, temporal happiness, but genuine happiness, the happiness of liberation and enlightenment to all living beings, then it's only natural we should have respect for them, appreciate what they're doing. So the next verse says, the Buddha has said that someone who generates an evil thought against such a benefactor as a child of the victors will remain in hell for as many eons as there were evil thoughts. So that's pretty heavy, but the reason is because bodhisattvas are doing such valuable work. And if we fail to appreciate that and even get angry at them and have negative thoughts towards them, then we're creating really heavy negative karma. So that's why they say that it's really, really negative to get angry at a bodhisattva or do anything harmful. That's because they're such precious beings. So, of course, you know, it might happen that anger would arise in our minds, but at least we need to recognize that and do whatever we can to overcome those feelings of anger. And the easiest way is just to remind ourselves of what they are doing, how precious they are, and, you know, respect them and appreciate them for the wonderful things that they are doing and their dedication to the benefit of all living beings. And we need to understand that this negative result of being angry at a bodhisattva is not because a bodhisattva will get angry at us in return, because the next verse says, but if one acts out of an attitude of faith, its fruits will multiply far more than that. Even in adversity, the children of the victors generate no negativity. Instead, their virtues naturally increase. So even if we do get angry at a bodhisattva and yell at a bodhisattva or do anything harmful, the bodhisattva will not get angry, will not think, you, blah, 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 and want to harm us in return, because their practice is to have compassion for all sentient beings, even those who may harm them. So that's not why it's so bad, it's so negative to get angry at or harmful towards a bodhisattva. It's bad for us, because of our failure to appreciate their incredible, wonderful qualities and, you know, feel that respect for them and want to support them. And then this verse also says the benefits if we have faith in the bodhisattva and respect them, support them, help them, and so forth, then there's a great amount of merit, virtue in doing that. Okay, one last verse for this chapter. So, conclusion, I prostrate to the body of he or she in whom the sacred precious mind is born. I seek refuge in that source of happiness who brings happiness even to those who harm him or her. I'm adding the her, the she, make it gender neutral. Yeah, if we can really rejoice in those who, even if they're not yet bodhisattvas, but trying to generate bodhicitta in their mind, trying to engage in bodhisattva deeds, trying to go in that direction. So it's really important that we rejoice in what they're doing, support them in what they're doing, appreciate them, and try not to get angry at them or critical of them or do anything to hinder what they are doing. Okay, so that was good timing.
What if we doubt that bodhisattvas can actually help sentient beings? Does it create negative karma?
So do we create negative karma by having doubt that bodhisattvas are able to do that? I don't think so. There's three kinds of doubt, depending on where you're leaning. One kind of doubt is leaning in the positive direction. So there you have doubt. You think, yeah, I'm not sure if bodhisattvas can really do all of that, but maybe they can. So you're kind of leaning towards a positive conclusion. That's not negative. The Dalai Lama says it's actually good to have doubt. We should have doubt. We should investigate. That's what Buddha encouraged us to do. Don't just blindly believe what he says, but investigate, check, analyze. So that kind of doubt is healthy. And then there's the other kind of doubt, which is on the opposite end, and that's leaning in the negative direction. That's where you think, I don't know if bodhisattvas can really do all of that. Probably not. It's probably just a lot of, you know, stories that aren't true. So you're leaning away from, you know, accepting that bodhisattvas can help. So that's said to be a negative doubt, because if you're not careful, that can lead you into wrong view, where you reject, no, bodhisattvas are just fooling themselves and fooling everybody else. It's impossible for them to help all sentient beings. I don't believe that at all. So you can actually go to that extent of wrong view, denying that such a thing is even possible. So that kind of doubt is negative. And then there's a third kind of doubt, which is in the middle, kind of leaning this way and then leaning that way, and you're just really not sure. So that one is also a little dangerous, because it could go in the negative direction, but it could also go in the positive direction. So it's good to have doubts. It shows that we're thinking rather than just having blind faith. But we shouldn't just get stuck in our doubts, because that can be paralyzing. That can be immobilizing. You just, I don't know. And then you can't move forwards. So if we do have doubt, we should find a way to get out of it. Like, think about it, talk with others, study more. I mean, I'm a person who has a lot of doubts, so I know this very well. But I find it helpful to, yeah, think and talk to people, investigate. And the more I study, the more I learn, the more my doubts go away somehow. So it's not wrong or bad, but it's just dangerous. So you got to be careful. Risky. It's a risky state of mind. I hope that's okay. I mean, just look at the Dalai Lama. I mean, to me, he's got to be a bodhisattva. And just look at all the good he's doing. Maybe he's not helping every single sentient being in the universe right now. Well, maybe he is. We don't know. We see a certain amount of things that he's doing, but maybe there's a lot other things he's doing that we can't even see. It's possible. Maybe he's in his sleep, you know, he's emanating all these beings out there and helping them. So it also, yeah, it's also helpful to recognize our own limitations, you know, that we are not able to see everything that there is about a person. We cannot see everything that a person might be doing. So it's good to have an open mind that there might be a lot more going on that meets our eyes, our mind. Okay, so maybe we can stop there for today.